Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding other people and understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. If you like the podcast, please share it with your friends and give it a rating on iTunes. I'm considering reducing the number of episodes I do substantially, so any encouragement you can give me is greatly appreciated. On today's episode, recorded October 1st, 2021, I interview Ben Tyler about how reading people and understanding people can play a role in the musical world, especially when it comes to playing jazz. A little bit about Ben Tyler. He's a musician and educator living in Portland, Oregon. He's been in many different bands and musical projects, has toured the U.S. extensively, and continues to compose and play regularly. Ben is currently teaching music theory at Portland Community College and drum lessons at Revival Drum Shop. One of the bands he's been playing with for a while is the pop duo Small Million. Ben's personal music project is called Small Skies, and the song that's currently playing is a song called Faces from the Small Skies album Build. You can follow Ben on Twitter at Small Skies. And also, by the way, my usual podcast intro music is also by Small Skies. Okay, here's the interview with Ben Tyler. Hey, Ben. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, Zach. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with, when it comes to understanding and predicting human behavior, reading behavior indicators, Has that played much of a role in your musical career?
Yeah. I feel like any performance type thing is going to be a lot about reading people. But I think maybe weirdly, the most important part of that is kind of the behind the scenes, being able to talk to people part of it, you know, like The politics of the business, I guess, being able to put yourself in front of people and not be too painfully awkward.
Not so much during the music, but the politics and the usual things that help people in their various careers of talking to people and networking with people and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's still that stage presence and rapport with people on stage. That's definitely a part of it. Mm-hmm. But like, I feel like just being not awkward and able to talk, especially to strangers and things like that, is a big, big part of it. I think I heard a quote from Michael Jackson, who I know has been canceled, but he said, like, somebody was asking him, like, how to make it in the music business. And he said, make yourself very, very, very easy to work with. Mm. And I really, for all the horrible things that guy's done, I think that that is very prescient and very, very true. And that has guided me, just being easy to work with.
Right. I think that is, for any job, almost more important than the actual skill you bring to the job. Because if people don't want to work with you, it doesn't matter how good you are. Yeah.
Yeah. They're just looking for an excuse to get rid of you. You know? Yeah.
So one thing that, when it comes to the performance aspect, one thing that strikes me is, maybe in jazz and improvisational music more than other music, there can be that aspect of trying to read what other people are doing, like knowing where you're at in a song or like who's going to take the next turn or things like that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how much that plays a role, or maybe it doesn't play much of a role at all. And those things are very minor.
I wouldn't say it's minor, especially with jazz. There's always like this kind of unspoken kind of rapport on stage, which is kind of hard to describe with words, obviously, because it's unspoken. But I guess it's a lot of when you play with somebody long enough, and I think especially with jazz, because it's so improvisational, there is a level of trust that needs to be established. And when you've played with somebody for however many months or years or something, you kind of just are able to predict their behavior just based on circumstances. It's almost like math equations where, you know, we come up against A plus B again, and you know this person's going to come out with a C, so to speak. And so just kind of knowing that, I think, is a big part of that. And so, like, especially with jazz, I think with jazz and as a drummer in jazz, it's such a trust thing where I can really make or break a soloist in a lot of ways. I can amplify what they're doing and make them sound cool and help them in their improvisation, or I can completely stomp all over it. I mean, there's count the ways you can ruin a solo. I can play way too loud. I can make it about me. You know, that's an interesting thing about accompanying a solo is sometimes you over accompany and try and like maybe show how great you are at helping this person.
It's a fine line. Yeah.
Lots of fine lines, lots of them.
That's what strikes me about it. And that's always what I found so hard in the little bit of jazz I played was, you know, and obviously I was far from professional, but the little bit I tried, it was always intimidating to me to try to figure out that line of, am I doing too much? Am I doing too little? And basically being like a non-entity, finding that line. And would you say that's something that you just, that comes with practice? Or do you think that some people are just understand where those lines are from listening to a lot of music and kind of internalizing it? Do some people understand it better from the beginning, or is it something that most people just start out pretty bad at and get better at?
I think it's all of the above, you know, like, I do think if you listen to the music, you have better instincts to begin with. If you have the type of brain that kind of understands music a little better, you have a leg up. But even, you know, I was listening to an interview with Elvin Jones, one of the greatest jazz drummers of all time. And he was talking about when he first started that he kind of had a bad reputation because he would play too much, you know, like he would probably be a little bit more in the over accompany camp where he was like inserting himself too much into the music for a lot of people at that time. And then it took somebody like John Coltrane to mesh with him well. So I think a big part of it, you know, after you are able to kind of at least do something that doesn't completely suck, finding the right people to mesh with, no matter how good or bad you are. Like if you are playing with somebody who is just not a good fit for you, and especially in an improvisational kind of scenario, it's not going to be good. And they'll think you are terrible no matter how great you are.
Mm-hmm. Are there some people that you would say are good technical musicians, but bad at these kind of softer and more intuitive skills? That's one thing I've wondered for me specifically, because I felt like there was some of that hardship of trying to, like, you know, kind of the social skills that we're talking about when it comes to working with a group. Do you feel like you've seen people like that, that are very good technically, but just suck at kind of the social integrations in a music group?
Yeah. And I've seen the opposite too, where somebody like has never practiced their instrument at all, but they have that intuition that helps them get through any kind of scenario. But like I was joking a while back with, I forget who, but we were talking about the people, you know, they just practice 8 hours a day and, you know, get their meals slipped under the door. And like, so, you know, their people skills are lacking, but their technique is amazing because all they do is practice their instrument. So, I mean, I see that. And there's a place for that. I mean, I love watching a great technical musician. It doesn't stimulate the part of my brain that maybe more of an artist does, but it does make me really excited to watch somebody who's just really amazing at anything, even outside of music. It's really cool to watch somebody who's really good at something. It's interesting how that works with just about anything, you know, any kind of skill. When there's a lot of technique involved, you got to respect it.
Yeah, it's almost like you know, playing a role playing game. There's like different skills you can work on to, you know, to achieve success. It's like, work on this skill, work on this skill, or break up your time on different skills, like playing with people versus, you know, just getting really good at your technical chops or whatever. Yeah. Let's see. Are there examples that come to mind of, you know, say you're playing with a jazz band, and are there examples that come to mind of kind of like reading minds or seeing what's coming next and how that plays a, you know, practical role in jazz music?
Sure. I mean, the funny thing about improv is how it can really be used to make it so there's no real rules. If people are able to pivot and think quickly, the possibilities are really endless, you know, and it kind of speaks to the African-American roots of jazz, because it comes from a place of, you know, being barred from getting some kind of formal musical education or something like that, where you just use your ears and you learn to improvise to make the most out of a situation. And so I remember being in school, and there was the jazz school and the classical school, and we'd sometimes mix together and like talk to each other and take classes and stuff like that. And one thing that I remember some of my friends who were in the classical school would talk to us about, because I was in the jazz school, they'd be like, it's so crazy how you all come to a show, because we'd play for each other every Friday. You'd have to go to a concert and watch either one of the classical ensembles or a jazz ensemble. And the jazz students would just not know what they're going to do, literally. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't even know the songs we were going to do sometimes. We would show up completely empty-handed with nothing and kind of discuss it on stage, which is in one way very unprofessional, because we'd just be like, so what do you want to do? Who wants to solo? I don't know. I remember kind of being embarrassed about that at one point, and I was just like, dudes, we should, you know, have our act a little more together. But I remember one of the classical students talking to us, and they liked that. They liked that we could show up with nothing and just kind of quickly put something together, and through improvisation, be able to make it work, you know? And that's what I like about improv. But I guess one of the downsides of that is the lack of preparation, you know? Like, if you lean on that too much, then when it comes to learning a precise song, you know, where it's like, okay, you can't improv your way through this. This is the part. You're either playing it correctly or incorrectly. Mm-hmm. That's maybe when improv kind of falls short a bit. And I remember a lot of jazz cats that I knew, when it came to even like a fairly simple like pop song, you know, or maybe especially a simple pop song where you can't just like noodle your way through it. It's like, this is the part. It's very simple and it's laid bare for all to hear it. They would have a hard time with it, you know, and it's interesting because everybody thinks about jazz cats as being, you know, like these technical wizards who can play anything. But a lot of times that gets in the way of just working on a part and just playing this part as it is every single time. And so, yeah, it's interesting how it's a bit of a double-edged sword sometimes.
I'm looking at this study from Wesleyan University about studying some brain patterns of musicians, and it says, I'm quoting from this article, the jazz musicians responded faster to unexpected changes than the other subjects. A similar study comparing jazz and classical musicians using brain scans also showed that jazz musicians were able to react to an unexpected change in chord progressions faster and with less neurological effort than their classically trained peers. And I'm wondering, do you feel like playing jazz has made you more flexible to things in life?
Yeah, I would think so. But I also think just being a working musician too, and especially during a pandemic, I feel like we're all, you know, it's like the cliche of pivoting now, right? But I think that's what improv is all about, is it's all about pivots. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like just being a working musician, I feel like too, is just, you know, you're always kind of like, well, okay, now I have to do this. Oh, okay, that's not working. How do I make this work? How do I keep going? But yeah, I do think having that part of your brain be a little more activated, because I remember reading something that was saying they did some CAT scans or brain scans, whatever it's called, where they were just looking at the brains of musicians when they're playing and improvising. And there was a part of the brain, it was jazz musicians and also freestyle rappers. You know, anytime you're like improvising, there's this one part of your brain that just kind of lights up. It is interesting, and I do think there is something to that.
Yeah, that's one thing I've noticed as, you know, I feel like I've improved a lot in the last few years at improvising on the, when I play piano, and it's kind of just getting used to hitting wrong notes and getting into those patterns of like, well, where do I go from there? You know, you got to have the mindset of like, there's no wrong notes. And then you kind of think about it from there. It's like, okay, I did this pattern before where I, you know, kind of muscle memory almost, where it's like, oh, I did this. And then I naturally know that something else follows that makes it sound better or whatever.
Yeah.
Did that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Herbie Hancock actually said that about Miles Davis. He was talking about Miles, and he said that there's this one time where, you know, they're playing a show somewhere and Herbie messed up, played a bad chord, played some wrong notes, and Miles almost instantly followed it and played along with him, which made it sound correct, which is crazy. And, you know, again, it speaks to the power of improv, where you can pivot like that and move that quickly. And it does kind of make it so you have this crazy freedom to just do that. But I will say this, because I always, every time I talk about something like that, there's always the other side of it, right? Because I think, you know, as the musician, as the person playing it, you're like, yeah, that's awesome. But does it sound good to the audience? And a lot of times it maybe doesn't. And maybe this is the part of jazz that the average listener who doesn't really like jazz doesn't really like, you know? They don't hear all of that. It's like, sure, technically this is working, and you know, we're staying together, but a lot of times people will listen to something like that and it just, they don't hear the connection. It sounds like gibberish to them and they don't like it. So
right, they're not appreciating what the musicians listening to it are appreciating. It's,
yeah.
A small note here. One thing I meant to ask Ben about is the flip side of this idea, how some people who don't play any musical instruments seem to put jazz on a sort of intellectual and romantic pedestal, almost a sort of fetishizement of jazz. These are people who seem to think of music and musicians as something magical and distant from them, as opposed to viewing music as something they too could easily be making. In other words, I think if some of those people got into playing jazz, their views of jazz would change, the pedestal they placed jazz on maybe would lessen a bit. I'm not saying this to judge this phenomenon, as I think fetishizement of things, putting things we like on pedestals in various ways, is a pretty common thing, and it can be part of what makes life magical and enjoyable for many people. When I asked Ben about this, he said, yes, I do agree that jazz is put on a pedestal in a lot of ways. It's taught in college now, which would be unthinkable when it was primarily played by black people back in the day. I've heard jazz described as the classical music of America, and I think people view it as similar in a lot of ways. This old codified form of music that's considered high art that most people don't really understand. You look very smart when you're into jazz. End quote.
If you're used to listening to music with just straight up hooks, and then you're listening to somebody improvise, you know, a hook to me is the exact opposite of improvisation. It's like you sit down and you craft. It's almost more like a sculpture in a way, where like you craft this the perfect hook for this musical moment. And in a way, like, especially as a person who grew up learning jazz and studying jazz, I was super fascinated by the art of just writing a good pop song with a great hook. I do feel like it gets like maligned sometimes,
and producing it really well, and
yeah, just polishing this thing till it is as perfect as it possibly can be. Jazz is the opposite. Like, you know, I always talk about my heroes and stuff because I kind of use that to give me perspective. But Elvin Jones, he said he never listened to his recordings ever. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, that's crazy. You never listened to.
Like Adam Driver, the actor.
It's like, how do you do that? And he said, like, because I'm insecure about it. I don't want to hear my mistakes. Mm.
Like, that's exactly what, I don't know if you heard that about Adam Driver.
I didn't.
He says he doesn't watch any of his scenes. He said he doesn't want to become self-conscious. Kind of a similar thing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's cool.
Hard to do.
Because in a weird way, that has a form of confidence in and of itself, right? If you're willing to just push this stuff out and just be like, it is what it is, whatever. Like, to me, whenever I am working on a recording, the thought of just, you know, doing something like that and just being like, it is what it is, and putting it out into the world is terrifying.
Right. It's like the difference between, feeling something and just focusing on the feeling, the internal feeling, versus examining it from outside. And you can imagine how Adam Driver is like, I feel like I'm in character and I don't really want to break the magic by seeing it from the outside. You know, similar idea, you know, it's like they're scared of ruining the magic because they know it feels right internally.
Yeah. And I guess maybe there's no real point in looking at it or listening to it after it's already done, you know? Mm-hmm. Like with
and as long as people are telling you you're doing a good job, I guess is the important part.
Well, that's really the only thing you can truly kind of gauge. Well, I don't know. I guess it's a balance between your own internal instincts about whether something was good and the audience and people telling you it was good.
But yeah, that's a tough. Yeah, that's a real tough line to know too.
Because yeah.
You could think you're a genius, and everyone could be telling you're an idiot.
Yeah, or so. Secretly thinking you're an idiot, because this is how people handle it in Portland. People think you're an idiot. People think you totally suck. Tell you you're amazing. Never come to your show. Tell all their friends how bad you are. You know.
Right. It's hard to. It's always hard to know what the reality is.
Yeah.
And reality for music or any performance, the reality is the. Is some sort of balance of what people perceive and what you're actually doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I do think though, there is a kind of unspoken reaction that people will have to good or bad music where you can just tell whether an audience really liked what you just did or not. Like no matter what people say, they can't fake it, whether they really, really like something or really, really don't. There is that whole, like, you know, just quietly clapping and like, hey, good job type of thing. But when somebody really, really likes something, there is a whole different kind of way that they react in real time as the music's happening afterwards. There's just an excitement that you can't really fake as an audience member. People try. I've seen it when they're like, yeah, that was great, Ben. Good job, buddy. But then there's like, you know, I've been there a few times where you just know you killed it. No one even needs to say anything.
When it comes to reading any cues of fellow band members, are there anything things that stand out? Like, for example, somebody getting lost in a song and you trying to do specific things to get them back, or else reading, what's coming next in a song. Are there any things that we haven't talked about, like specific instances that stand out, like real granular instances?
I think, you know, again, a lot of unspoken stuff. A lot of times I can tell how a band member is feeling, you know, just by body language and the look on their face. I've had many instances where I just know this person is mad at me because they give me a look, you know, and that's a big part of it. But even based on the way somebody's playing, especially in an improvisational aspect, you can kind of, I think a big part of it is excitement versus not being excited. So sometimes when I'll be playing in an improvisational way and accompanying a soloist or something, you know, a good solo will have kind of like peaks and valleys of energy and excitement. And so, like, if I'm feeling this musician starting to build up the energy, build the excitement in their improv solo, and I'm meeting them and pushing them in the right way, and they're feeling it, it's kind of this feedback loop of excitement and energy that pushes them. And you can kind of hear it in, you know, the notes they choose to play, the way the audience is reacting, the busyness of their solo, that sort of a thing. You can kind of tell where they're feeding off of my energy and it's helping them. And then, like, it just builds this excitement. But I've also had the opposite where, like, you know, I'll almost, it'll be like I'm feeling them starting to try to build some kind of excitement or something. And then I try to accompany that. I try and be like, ooh, yeah, like here, what if I play this, you know? And for whatever reason, they don't like it. And it kills their excitement. And it kind of flops in a weird way.
Right, it's just not meshing in some way.
Yeah, it's not meshing. They might, you know, think I'm trying to hog the spotlight or I'm getting in the way of what they're doing or distracting them. But you can hear it in the way they're playing. Like, I'll, you know, I've had it happen before where, you know, like I was saying, they're trying to build some excitement and then I will try and help and then they just withdraw and they're like, never mind. It's like,
yeah. The chemistry wasn't there for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Well, this is kind of a semi-autistic question, but, you know, when I watch jazz musicians or I guess band members in general, they'll make eye contact at important parts of the song, and I'm always wondering, like, what are they communicating something?
What's going on
with that eye contact? Yeah. Like, could you do that just as easily without making the eye contact, or is there something happening with the eye contact? Is it aiding in some way?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's all any unspoken kind of communication is being used by musicians, and I would say probably anybody on stage, because you can't just be like, "Hey, don't do that." In front of an audience, you know, you always have to like hide the inner workings to the audience, at least for stuff like that. And so, I mean, you know, things like eye contact, hand gestures, you know, in fact, there's like a whole kind of like almost like a canon of hand gestures, especially in the jazz world, that means something. Like when you put up a fist, that usually means this is the last time through this solo section. We're going on now. And different things like that. So, I mean, when it comes to eye contact, a lot of times it could mean something we already talked about. Like, you totally screwed up again, and I just heard it. You know, James Brown would do that all the time.
I'm watching you.
Yep. It's just like, I heard, because James Brown, like, I don't know if you knew this, like, he would dock pay from his band members if they screwed up.
Oh boy.
Yeah. No, dude, different time, I guess. But like, he was hardcore. And so there are all kinds of stories of James Brown just like shooting looks at you.
Your pay like, is docked.
Stare. Yeah. It's just like, yep, that's $20.
That's one way to, one way to get it done. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, put the fear of God into your bandmates. But, you know, a lot of times too, a lot of times it'll just be like, I can't believe we're in this awesome musical moment too. You know, like I was just playing with a band I've been playing with lately, Small Million, and we were just playing Treefort Music Festival in Boise. And we were playing in this funky, weird little space, and it was a little stressful and all this stuff before the show, as it often can be. But then we started playing. It's so interesting because there's like the vibe before the show, there's the vibe during the show, and then there's the vibe after the show. And before the show, we were pretty stressed because most festivals, unless you're like a big time artist, they're kind of like, okay, go play now. And so it can be really stressful. And so when we were playing, when we were on stage, we started to vibe and it started to feel really good. And that's when we were just kind of looking at each other and smiling and just being like, this is awesome. You know, that's when I look and I smile and we're like, we're feeling good. And those moments are awesome. Yeah. And a lot of times, especially as a side musician, I really try and foster that, because when you're the lead musician, lead singer, the person out front, the one that everybody's watching, that's super stressful. it's really make or break. And so as a side musician, I really try to make it so that when they look at me, they get a lift. They get some energy. Yes, yeah. Positive. Even, and maybe especially, if things are going horribly. Mm-hmm. They I want to be their rock. And I want to make their job easier, not harder. And so a lot of times, there's a lot that can go into those looks on stage. That could mean lots of stuff. It could be a very important thing, or it could just be like a, you know, hey, here we are having fun. This is hilarious. You know, there have been many different instances of different kinds of looks I've gotten, I feel like.
Yeah, I guess that gets to your point you were making at the beginning of saying some of the softer skills of reading people and giving that energy are part of what increase your chances of success in the music world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, like, if you're Beyonce, none of that matters, you know, like you don't need to be easy to work with. In fact, like if you're a diva, they call you a diva for a reason. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's, you're the person who's bringing people in here.
You're past that point of having to, do all that stuff.
You can do whatever you want at that point. But for like a working musician like me, mm-hmm. It's really important to be easy to work with, make people's job easier. Not harder.
And see see what their needs are before they see it and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
I was thinking too about the eye contact, you know, the other thing there, and you kind of mentioned it with the hand gestures, but I'm sure you're also theoretically seeing the rhythm and able to match the rhythm when you look at somebody too. So whether that's like their current rhythm or like a rhythm they're getting ready to do, like mm-hmm. you're getting ready to, you know, making a gesture in the air, like getting ready to hit the drums or whatever. I guess that's a big mm-hmm. part of it too. It's like, I feel like you're able to add to the audio aspect with another dimension of like actually seeing the rhythm, you know, and seeing it coming or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Or like, and there's also kind of almost like this algorithmic kind of knowledge where, you know, if somebody is playing a certain thing, the chances of them playing this other thing to end it, like, or like if somebody starts an idea a certain way, they're going to need to finish it either this way, or this way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a math equation.
Several paths, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you can kind of predict what somebody's going to do based on the way they start something. And so if you're able to kind of think about that beforehand, it makes it so that you are a lot quicker on the draw. You're more engaged in a good way, and you can kind of plan what you're going to do in reaction to that. Mm-hmm. So that's always kind of interesting too. Yeah, you get that from just listening to tons and tons of music. I always, you know, because I teach as well, and one of my big kind of initial tests for students is just asking them what they listen to. And one of the big bummers is when they're like, I don't really listen to music. And I'm like, this could be a difficult problem. Yeah, why would you? Other than, you know, you saw somebody on TV and you want to, you know, have an audience adore you or something. And I'm like, well, just become an influencer or something, you know, something easier than being a musician.
Yeah.
You know, if you just want people to love you, then, you know, post videos on YouTube or something.
Or their parents are making them do it or something like that.
That too. Yeah. That's maybe the worst. That's the worst thing as a music teacher ever, is when mom and dad or whoever is just like, okay, little Billy, go to drum lessons. I want a drummer for a child. Like, don't force your kids to be a musician. Like, I understand like you wanting your kids to do something, but it doesn't have to be music. They can do sports. They can do anything, you know, like it's playing music when you don't want to is terrible.
Although I will say in defense of that, I was forced to, I wouldn't say forced. I mean, I didn't object when I was a child, you know, pretty young child, to taking piano lessons, and I hated it at the time. Like, I just wouldn't practice. You know, I always dreaded the piano lessons because I was like, I'm going to be made a fool of again because I didn't practice and all this stuff. And I only, mm-hmm. I learned a little bit of piano, and then finally, you know, I stopped for a while. And then in high school, I finally appreciated it again because I was like, oh, I can impress people with this. And I was, you know, that, I mean, you know, it's sort of getting at your thing. It's like, but then, you know, then again, I, I didn't have the drive like you did and many people did to have actually, you know, be a musician, because it wasn't what drove me, but I mm-hmm. there still was that, you know, it's still a fun pastime for me that I can enjoy. So I wanted to give the you know, you won't necessarily have the drive to be a great musician, but you may enjoy it at some time, even if your parents force you to do it.
Yeah, and you know, and also to disagree with what I just said, like, you know, I've had a lot of students where they really don't like it at first because mm-hmm. it is work. It's really funny because they'll come in and you're like, yeah, I love drums, I love music, da, da, da. And they're like, okay, well, this is how you start. This is how you hold a drumstick. Mm-hmm. And it's not as glamorous or exciting as they thought, and you can see the disappointment on their face. But to your point, there's that initial phase, but then when they are able to both look back and be like, oh wow, I am better now, I'm able to do this thing, and then also get reactions from other people, mm-hmm. and people are like, oh wow, you can play music, that's cool. That's when
positive reinforcement, yeah,
exactly. That's when people start to be like, oh okay, all right, now I understand why I should practice this.
Yeah, and I should say it wasn't just that I enjoyed it later for purposes of impressing people, though that initially in high school was like, oh, girls might be impressed by that, but then I also enjoyed it too. I mean, I do like playing now and like playing then. I like playing more now than I did then, but yeah.
The wanting to be cool and sexy aspect of learning a musical instrument is real and powerful.
Oh yeah.
It's huge.
Well yeah,
it's huge.
I mean, the sex drive, you know, Freud would have us believe it was behind everything, but I don't believe that, but it's definitely behind a lot of endeavors.
It helps. Especially, it helps. You know, for me, when I was a kid, you know, I felt very awkward, like a lot of kids. I had a hard time talking to girls, and playing music was something I could talk about, and it was something mm-hmm. that wasn't awkward and something I could do. So it definitely was a thing, you know.
Does it surprise you how cool music is perceived, like whether it was when you were younger or even now? You know, it's music is so perceived as so cool, and musicians are perceived as so cool. And are you surprised by that, or do you think there's something easy to understand about that?
Well, I mean, I don't think that surprises me, because I mean, I've always, you know, since I was a little kid, been obsessed with music. So to me, musicians are cool. I'm still a huge fan. I still, you know, whenever I get to see one of my musical heroes play or like talk to them or something like that, I still just fanboy out, and it's like amazing. But the thing that does surprise me, I think, is kind of silly and maybe a bit of an indictment on American culture, is when people think that people like musicians should be, you know, running the country, or you know, like, or have some kind of knowledge about, you know, the world.
Stuff.
Yeah, it's just like, dude, yeah. We're just performers. You know, like, why don't you listen to actual philosophers, people like, you know, academics, experts? You know, why don't we listen to experts more? Musicians are experts at music, not other stuff.
Kind of reminds me of my roommate in college, where he would listen to like punk and other genres, metal, and he was trying to explain to me the philosophy of their lyrics, and I was like, yeah, I don't really get my philosophy from punk music, you know. Sorry, that's not, you know, I'm not gonna, that's not where I choose to get my ideas from. Sorry. I mean they could have good ideas, I'm not debating that, but it is like, I'm listening to music for the musical enjoyment, not for the philosophical you know, lyrics or something. Yeah
I mean, there is something to it, because like, you do have to have something to say to get up on stage and say it to begin with, you know, like I'll listen to, you know, like a Bob Dylan song or something like that, and there is this kind of deep kind of
folk music, and, you know. I take it back. Yeah, Bob Dylan very much affected me. I take it back.
Sure. And I would say, you know, punk artists too, like, you know, as a person who studied in college, the whole kind of punk ethos is really punk ethos. It was really important in a way because punk's all about just embracing the dirt and the grime and your mistakes and sounding like shit, but being like, yeah, that's shit, and I'm reveling in it. You know, that's kind of an important thing to think about. So I kind of am sticking up for your roommate a bit, I guess.
Well, I'll say, I think it's like the nice thing about music is it can get across these ideas for people that would probably never crack crack a book to get those ideas or something. You know, it's like,
yeah,
they're a way to communicate to more directly to the masses, like for the people that aren't going to sit down and read like equivalent books about the same ideas or something. Right.
Yeah. Well, and you know, to your point, I think especially for younger people and kids, I'm not going to sit down as a 12-year-old and read Nietzsche, but
I'll listen to a punk song. Though,
yeah. You know, and Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember from my very religious family, somebody, we were having like a family dinner and some people from my church over, and they were like, somebody said, you know that band Nine Inch Nails? Do you know how they got their name? They got their name because it was the Nine Inch Nails that nailed Christ to the cross. And which I later found out, I heard an interview with Trent Reznor, that's totally not true. I think he just said that it just sounded cool. And which makes much more sense. But I remember hearing that and being like, ooh, this Nine Inch Nails band sounds dangerous.
Bad Boys.
I need to find out what's going on with that. So I like snuck in some Nine Inch Nails into my house. And, you know, that was like my first introduction to the ideas of Nietzsche was through Nine Inch Nails. And so I think in some ways, especially when you're maybe living somewhere where ideas are suppressed and you're young, and the idea of sitting down and reading Nietzsche, there's no way I could have. I wouldn't have understood it. But, you know, artists, and maybe that's where artists and musicians do, their role is important, is to kind of disseminate.
Gateway drug kind of.
Exactly.
Into ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Put an idea out there in a way that the average person can digest and understand a little bit better, and then make it so that they're thinking about that stuff more, you know?
Next up is a section where Ben talks about the hidden dynamics and structure of songs that people may be enjoying without really understanding what's going on under the surface.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a magic show, right? When you're doing a magic trick for somebody, it's about what they're not seeing. That's where the actual
sleight of
trick
hand.
Is. Yeah. And, you know, for me, I remember when I was a kid and there were certain things that would just give me goosebumps, certain things about music that would just really kind of just give me a physical reaction. And like, I remember one of them was an ascending chord progression, just chords going up and up and up and up on a scale. For whatever reason, when I was a kid, it would just like get me super riled up and super amped and give me goosebumps and stuff like that. So I you know, and I see that at concerts too, where I'm playing, you know, an audience is like a weird kind of organism, you know, kind of like a mob mentality, but in a performance aspect, and the way they react to certain musical devices. And they don't even know it, really. They don't know that this thing that we're doing, this kind of sophisticated chord progression or this kind of rhythmic tension that I've been building. And now I think the best example is like when a beat drops, you know, it's like you build up the rhythmic tension, like dun 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 dun, and then when the beat drops and everybody's just like goes nuts. And if you were to ask them, like, why are you going nuts? Why is it about that? And they probably wouldn't be able to put it into words. It's
right. We can't. Yeah.
It's hard to talk about. Why is it that, you know, this musical device that somebody employed made you go crazy? And, you know, if you really study it and look into it, it's kind of the math of the music and like people's expectations, violating those expectations, but then not too much. There's so much like tension and release and what you think is going to happen and what actually does happen. Whenever you're listening to music, you're people are predicting what's going to come next. And then the way the musicians either do exactly what you think is going to happen or kind of do what you think is going to happen.
Yeah.
Or do something completely the opposite. Mm-hmm. Really affects how you enjoy the music.
Yeah, that's kind of like comedy. I mean, you when you watch a good comedian that you like, it's they're adhering to a certain pattern that we're used to, the comedic template, but their skill comes in how they subvert slightly these various expectations we have of jokes we've heard before. So it's mm-hmm. like kind of a similar thing where it's like they're playing these templates but subverting expectations in subtle ways. Yeah.
And people love it. They love audiences really like when you surprise them a little bit, because if you completely
go off the charts,
violate their like they think they're going to see a symphony orchestra and it's death metal, they will be upset. They're not going to be happy at all. And then if you do exactly what they expect, then they get bored. Mm-hmm. And so it's this fine line. And you can kind of tell this about different musicians, like where on that spectrum are you willing to completely throw your audience under the bus and just like completely violate everything they thought they were going to get? Or are you wanting to play it completely safe and do exactly what your audience wants? Only the hits every single time, mm-hmm. nothing different. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody kind of has to find their spot on that spectrum.
Anything else you want to share about what you're working on these days or how people can follow you?
Yeah, I'm playing Small Skies is my band. Just put out a new track that was on a compilation of a bunch of Portland bands called PDX Pop Now. And that actually dropped today, October 1st. So you can find that. Also, another band, Small Million, all my small bands. We just played, Small Million just played Tree Fort Festival. Yeah, that's what I'm mostly doing these days. I also teach over at Portland Community College and Revival Drum Shop. So just trying to stay busy.
And your Twitter is, do you want to share Twitter or any social media?
Yeah, yeah, Small Skies. Everything is Small Skies. You can find me anywhere.
Yeah, I recommend Small Skies. I recommend Small Million. And that's a coincidence, right? That's not your...
Yes, total coincidence.
The small there. Yeah, okay.
Although I'm trying to like maybe reframe it as like it's not, because then it makes it sound cool. It's just like it's my artistic vision, uh-huh. but it totally isn't.
Okay.
We're just really, really good friends.
I didn't mean to call you out there. Okay.
No, it's okay.
All right, thanks a lot.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
This has been an interview with Ben Tyler. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can learn more about this podcast at behavior-podcast.com. If you like this show, please consider sharing it on social media and giving me a rating on iTunes. It's much appreciated. The music playing now is the song Faces by Small Skies.